Tonight on Arena, Martin Hayes on his new album, Peggy's Dreams, and Infinity Pool, God's Creatures, The Five Devils and John Wick 4 are the movies up for review. Five on 551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Thursday night reviews as usual to start the programme this evening. Emily Watson stars in God's Creatures as the ultimate Irish mammy. And sure, why wouldn't she be when Paul Mescal is playing her son? Maybe it's in the genes. Brandon Cronenberg is back doing Cronenberg things, this time with Infinity Pool, a violent and disturbing satire on wealth. Is it possible to make a horror film without her at the moment, the her being Mia Goth? Cinema's favourite 1990s boyfriend, Keanu Reeves, is also back in action mode for John Wick Chapter 4. And we look at The Five Devils, French psychodrama revolving around the strange goings-on for a family in the present day and also in the past. Lewis Barton and Paul Whittington will explain all. And we're going to start now this evening with God's Creatures, set in a South Coast fishing village. What's the basic setup here, Ruth?
Yeah, so it's set. This is a film set in the 1990s, somewhere in the South Coast. I mean, actually, it was shot in Donegal, so it's a little vague as to where it's actually. Well, it's taken place somewhere in the South. And it revolves around this woman, Aileen, played by Emily Watson. She works in a local fishing factory. And at the beginning of the film, one of the women's sons drowns. And immediately afterwards, Aileen's own son, who's played by Paul Mescal, returns unexpectedly from Australia. And because this is the 1990s, there's no, communication.
There was no internet, there was no text.
Yeah, so he appears unexpectedly. And we guess very soon that he's left, there's something's gone wrong in Australia and he's come back, but we're not being told what it is. She and then her daughter lives nearby. Her daughter has a new baby. And then he's come back, the Paul Mescal character's come back and wants to go back and set up the family oyster fishing farm again. But he has no money behind him, so he also has to kind of engage in slightly nefarious activities in order to keep the money coming
in.
Yeah,
so there's a little bit of under-the-counter money being exchanged with various ne'er-do-wells around the village.
But that's right.
And pretty innocent stuff in some ways in comparison to what transpires a little bit later on, which kind of, the Mescal character, he's a nice enough fella, it seems, even though we kind of wonder, how did he get back from Australia, what was he doing there and all of that? But he seems straightforward enough until.
Yeah, he seems affable enough, and yet you feel that he's been coddled a bit by his mother and that their relationship is slightly, I don't know, Oedipal or something. It's you know, she's very excited that he comes home. His dad is throwing his eyes to heaven. And she gets dressed up to go out to the pub with him. She leaves him in the pub and he meets his sort of former girlfriend, who's played by Aisling Franciosi, and Sarah, who also works in this processing plant with Aileen.
The Emily Watson character.
Yes. And the next day she alleges that he attacked her, that he
raped her,
essentially. And then Aileen faces this kind of Hobson's choice, you know, should she can't believe that he would do anything like that. Should she provide an alibi for him?
Well, here she is being asked by the Gardaí, will she? Well, by the Garda,
yes,
it is in this particular case, the wonderful Andrew Bennett, after his Colleen Kuhn outing. Here he is as Garda Mike in God's Creatures, asking Aileen, the Emily Watson character, about where Brian was on the night of said assault.
Sorry to drag you all the way into town. You must be delighted to have Brian back in the house with you.
Sure, you know yourself.
Sure I can. God knows if my girls moved back into the house, we'd be tearing strips off each other. Australia he was it?
Australia, yeah.
And that always the way. Breaking his mother's heart.
Exactly.
Look, there's been a claim made about an assault in the village a couple of weeks back by a young woman who was in Danielle's pub on the night of the 18th of April. Brian says he was at home with you that night. Is that right?
He was, yeah.
He didn't go out renting at any stage?
No.
And you'd say that again in court?
I would, yeah.
There we go. That's Emily Watson as Aileen, the mother of the Paul Mescal character who's been accused of this assault, and Garth Mike, played by Andrew Bennett, there asking her if she'll present him with an alibi. When I spoke to Emily Watson about this, she said, oh, it's a kind of an animal response. She doesn't rationalise or think about it at all. Now, things transpire later on in the movie, Ruth, for sure. But what is the type of community, the family and community, what kind of place are we talking about in this film?
Yeah, it all gets very, very nasty for Sarah, the young woman who's brought the rape accusation against Brian, because the community closes ranks against her. And so she's ostracised when she goes into the pub,
That's a very powerful scene, isn't it?
Yeah,
where
yeah.
The barman makes a kind of joke when he basically won't serve her. And they're leaving. He says, careful, someone doesn't follow you. And all the men start laughing.
So it's a closed, backward community. And I mean, this is slightly my beef with the film, that I know that we have a whole history of portraying rural Ireland of the past as this enclosed patriarchal society, and this film absolutely exploits that to the final degree. So there's something quite predictable about that. But what I find odd about it is that it doesn't really give us space in time between now and then, because it also has quite a modern feel to it. Mm. So
I didn't notice about half an hour in, bit of a dimwit, I thought, hang on, nobody's got any phones. That's the first time I noticed.
Yeah, and the money, yeah. the coins are our own money.
So there weren't many signs that
you had to be alert to that.
So if you're coming to this and you didn't pick up those signals, you'd say, oh, that's what rural Ireland is like now. And I kind of felt bad about that, because I was actually in Donegal when this was being shot. Mm. Rural Ireland isn't like that. And maybe it was in the 1990s, but I think I just kind of minded that sense of rural Ireland being that enclosed, patriarchal,
and the film is directed by two Americans.
Yeah, well, vicious kind of space. And you're really gunning for her. Leave it.
Yeah,
get out of there fast.
I mean, could it have been? Could that have been remedied quite easily? Yeah, you would have had to deal with phones and they would have known he was coming home and stuff like that. But the essential dynamic of the story could have existed in contemporary Ireland, as in the dilemma of the mother for the son. That still could have happened that way.
Absolutely. The strengths of this film are in the acting, particularly Emily Watson, who is excellent.
Oh, fantastic.
It's amazing performance. Yeah. It's so deep. And I mean, we always go on about accents. Her accents is excellent. You wouldn't know where she was from here somewhere, you would think, from the country. And she really, she's so earthy as an actor. She really grounds it. There are a few, there are some things I liked about it. The best scenes, excluding the ones involving her, are out on the oyster beds, and it's very, it's very elemental, and the tide comes in too fast, you have to watch that and all that sort of stuff, and that was all well done. But it set in the 90s, it was a bit like it was made in the 90s, because it was very talky, as Irish films used to be, lots of blather, overwritten at times, I felt, but the acting is very strong.
Yeah, and other with the performances, did they work? I know you have that beef with the
Donegal thing.
Which having said that.
Yeah, no, I do. I had to get that out. Yeah.
And I know you were talking about the Donegal thing. Yeah, that's because you knew it was in Donegal.
Yeah, no,
I don't think anybody watching it would know that.
Absolutely. No, that's, I mean, you wouldn't know where it was.
Yeah.
And that's fine. No, I mean, I thought that, I absolutely agree. I think Emily Watson, she gets it. There's something about her eyes, the way, she's got these incredibly piercing blue eyes. And it actually brought me back to Breaking the Waves, the film that made her name, that was her debut film.
And she was nominated for an Oscar for, as Paul Mescal was for After Sun, which I mentioned to them on the day as well.
There is a real symbiosis between those two films. They do lead one into the other in terms of, this isolated community and this woman within it. So, I mean, I did think that, although there are, and Aisling Franciosi is very, very good.
She is.
She's really good. And she sings, a fine singing voice. And that strikes a chord. I thought the others got slightly pushed to one side. There's a very minor subplot around father-in-law, played by Lola Roddy, who has dementia of some kind. And one of Brian's stronger characteristics is that he's the only one who can make the breakthrough and communicate with him. So that's sort of plus on his side.
And also, Emily Watson did the Cúpla Focal Gaelic with the Lola Roddy character speaks Irish.
Yes.
And she does the Cúpla Focal very well.
She has musical ear. She gets,
Paul Mescal obviously taught her.
Yeah, he probably did.
Anyway, overall, what did you think of this film and stars from you, Paul?
I thought that it was both solid and kind of stolid, and I thought that the acting, particularly Emily Watson, saved it and made it watchable. There were some interesting things that I'd give 3 stars.
Three. And what are you saying overall, Ruth?
Exactly the same, 3 stars. And I think, you know, many of them are for Emily Watson. Fantastic performance in it.
All right. Okay. Let us move on then to Infinity Pool. Well, the author of Questionable Ability finds himself in quite the pickle abroad when he is on the hook for accidentally killing a local. Infinity Pool, starring Alexander Skarsgård and Mia Goth, is Brandon Cronenberg's violent fable of crime, punishment and doppelgangers. You know, if I took the Brandon out of that, yeah, you'd be forgiven to think I was talking about some other Cronenberg. Yeah. Obviously bears the influence of his father, David, here. Does it have much to say?
Don't go on about that. Have you talked to him? I interviewed him last week.
Did you mention the war?
He was fine, but he said we're related, so we probably be, you know, so I think that, but he was okay about it. Mm. Yes, absolutely. There is that influence there. And I think I liked this film slightly more than Ruth did. I got that impression. I have to say, I thought it was interesting. It is Charnel House stuff at times. It is pretty violent, you know, disembowelings and whatnot. But
necessarily so?
Well, morally so, basically. It's a very moral film. It's about what is left of you when societal rules break down. What is left? Not much, according to Mr. Cronenberg. But I like the way he put the film together. Alexander Skarsgård's kind of cast against type. He plays this very passive person. He's a bad writer, basically. And he wrote a book and he's been forgotten about now. He married a rich wife and she thinks he's a bit of a loser. Mm. You get the sense she's going to get rid of him shortly. And then he meets Mia Goth, who gushes about his first book, which nobody else ever has. And of course, he's dragged into this idea of himself. And all things right. go bad from there.
Rather than ask one of you, I'm going to let Mia Goth's character explain what an infinity pool is.
Oh, no, better woman.
Here she is in a scene. They're on this isolated island resort, the Alexander Skarsgård character, James, the novelist, and he's guided by this young, quite seductive and quite mysterious character called Gabby, played by Mia Goth, and she is explaining what happened in the infinity pool of the film's title.
The first year we came, Alban was working as a consultant on the construction of a new resort, the Bot V2. Do you know it?
No.
It's just a few compounds over from here, north up the beach. They were installing an infinity pool, one of Alban's designs. A little pervy with a glass bottom that you could look up into from the bar. But the plates split and fell off the crane and 2 workers were killed. The owner of the Botbury put the blame on Alban and so we were arrested. Penalty of death. And we made a discovery then that you have now discovered.
A discovery.
Are you upset? Maybe think of it as a gift.
And that is Mia Goth and Alexander Skarsgård there in a scene from Infinity Pool. And Ruth, Skarsgård only has a couple of words in there, but you can almost see him in the scene, that wonderful stillness that he has.
He's fantastic because he's this big kind of hunk. I mean, he's a gorgeous looking man. And part of the sort of point of the film is the way that he's filmed is he's quite vain and it points out his vanity because he's almost posing for the camera. And he's so flattered when Gabby has read his book, though later on, you know, it's no secret, she's only making it up. She hasn't, you know, nobody's read his book. And so he's very solid, he's very vain, and then he gets lured in by her into it's basically a honey trap.
I mean, she was so well reviewed recently for Pearl, and you're almost thinking of there going to be films called Mia Goth films. She's almost she's a little genre all to herself.
We were just saying she's like the sort of public school girl who's gone very bad.
I'd love to see her do a kind of romantic comedy or something like that.
Really straight. But with a name like Goth, you've no choice.
She's been handed it.
And how is she in it then?
She's very good. I mean, I thought. You know, I didn't, as Paul was saying, I didn't love this film. I thought, and I actually didn't find it as intelligent as it thought it was. And I, you know, here's the comparison. I think, you know, David Cronenberg's films, there's so much kind of intellectual heft there. And I thought this film was far more surface and sort of splash and splatter. Mm. But she's good. And I thought it was slightly a one note. It, you know, she keeps doing the same thing throughout the film and it doesn't develop.
Yeah, I know what you mean in terms of her performance, but it's kind of, it's supposed to be shrill, I suppose.
And yeah, it gets very shrill on a bus trip.
It does. I think there are some interesting ideas for me in it, like the idea of the double, because I don't think we've explained that they knock somebody over, and on this island nation of Latuk, I think it is, basically, if you kill somebody, a local, for a fee, they'll make a clone, and it gets.
It's very cruel.
It gets killed.
It gets killed instead of you, and you watch it. So this whole thing about the double, like who got killed and who didn't. There's this whole thing about masks, but the morality in its absence was what I did find interesting. I know it was a bit advertised at times, and I thought she was great, and so was he. But she sits at one point. The funniest thing is she sits on the hood of a car. They've just cornered this bus. He's trying to leave the island. She won't let him, and she reads him this awful review of his book and makes him listen to it, that's horror for you.
Yeah, and it is funny. It has a good black humour to it. I enjoyed that. I just thought it was too long and it played out that kind of shrieky horror.
Is it unfair? I mean, Paul has mentioned the fact that he interviewed Brandon Cronenberg last week or recently in recent times. Is it, you know, Nepo Baby, all of those terms?
Is it hard to be fair? Do you mean maybe?
Is it fair that why do we mention David Cronenberg? Here I am doing it, but why?
Because
should
these are very, very similar. There's a genetic similarity between father and son's films.
If he was making musical comedies, we could possibly move away from that.
But because these are films about body horror and about doppelgangers and with relation in kind of physical decay, and then also about destroying the beautiful body.
So then I do have to ask, is he as good as his father in terms of this film?
Well, he's young.
I think he's
I did like the last thing he did with Andrea Riseborough. Did you see that? That was good.
Yeah, The Possession. He goes off and he has these like crazy disco strobe light sequences that were in Possessor and that were in this, and they just lose me.
All right. A mixed review here is what I'm getting from the two of you. So, what is your judgment on it?
I thought it was good enough, but it lost it. So, a 3 out of 5.
Three out of five
is kind of a grand, isn't it? I would give it 4 out of 5 because I liked it. I thought it was good and icky.
Good and icky. I can see it on the poster already.
It's a late night watch.
Yeah, it is.
Good and icky, Infinity Pool, and God's Creatures. That's the first two of our four films this evening. We'll be back with more from Ruth and Paul shortly. We'll be talking about John Wick Chapter 4 and The Five Devils. Now the debate starts. Keanu Reeves' status as bankable action hero is utterly assured, in case anybody out there was wondering. From Point Break through the various Matrix iterations, he's back with John Wick Chapter 4, which sees his rogue assassin in trouble with his colleagues once again. I'm sure we're going to have a debate about Keanu Reeves' acting ability at some point along the way here. Maybe not between Paul and Ruth.
But once you're four chapters in, i.e. four films into a series of films, you know what's expected of you. And he doesn't actually have to deliver, say, chunky monologues.
He doesn't say much at all.
He has about 5 lines in the entire film, which is probably 4 lines more than he had in the
previous
film.
He does them well, though, Sean.
He says, "I need a gun."
Yeah, he does. He said, "I need a gun."
He says, "I need a gun," in each film, I think.
I wonder how many words. I'd love to work out how much he said per word. Of course, film is not a word medium, so let that one
and
go.
And these are very, very visual.
Very visual. Yeah.
So, Paul, we're on chapter 4. Yeah. What do we need to know about chapters 1, 2, and 3?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. You could go into this and not have seen them. Yeah, well, basically, to summarise, in John Wick 1, he had retired from being a hitman. He was a mafia hitman, well known. He retired to be with his wife. She got sick and died. Then this Russian mobster shot his dog. He emerges from retirement, kills that fella, everybody who ever met that fella. Then in the second one, he was declared, there's this kind of church of assassins, and he was declared excommunicado. He goes on the run. Every Egypt with a gun was after him. And then in the third one, the last one, other stuff happened in the desert, and he killed lots of people.
Excommunicado. you know, we.
I know.
Because it's got its own. It's got its own world.
It does. It does, and it's a sort of Latinate and very ornate. And so that's what's happened. And in this one, they're all still out to get him, but he is after the people on the high table, the bosses of this, because he's sick of it all.
Right.
And he is on the run across the world, basically.
Okay, so the Ruska Roma character here, John Wick is what is,
yeah,
that's such him. Now he has to take out Killa. Will you explain to me who Killa is?
Killa,
is the Scott Atkins character.
Killa is.
Is the Scott Atkins? Scott Atkins.
Well, he has to get the French guy.
The French guy is the Marquis de Grammont. He starts trouble, basically, Sean, not to get technical, by killing the elder, who is this. Mm-hmm. He is the chief of the whole thing. And after that, this Marquis de Grammont, who's played with a real flourish by Bill Skarsgård, brother of the other Skarsgård, who we just talked about, who is this very kind of ornate, kind of slightly effeminate Bond villain type person who goes to the opera on his own. He makes ballerinas dances for him in an empty theatre. He's that kind of person. He devotes all resources to killing Wick, but Wick cannot all be right. killed, it seems. Okay.
Yeah, let us you fix your yeah. feature a clip then with Bill Skarsgård. He will keep it in the family and John Wick, Keanu yeah. Reeves, who he has challenged the Marquis, Bill Skarsgård, to a duel in order to win his freedom. But they turn the cards to decide on the elements of the duel, and the rules of engagement are overseen here by a character called the Harbinger, played by Clancy Brown. It all makes total sense to somebody.
You come here thinking there is a way out of this world for you, Mr. Wick. There is not. The Centre Pompidou.
Sacré-Cœur. Sacré-Cœur. Weapons.
If you win, the table will honor its word. You will have your freedom. But you won't take it. Blades.
Pistols. Dueling pistols. 30 paces. In the event that both parties survive, each will approach the other at increments of 10 paces until only one remains.
Yeah, actually, no, I'm listening there. Let me take everything back.
We should point out that it's not a complex film. It actually doesn't really matter what you know or who anybody's name is. The Marquis de Grammont, it's obvious who he is. There are some nice slower moments in this film, but it is all about action, and the action is spectacular.
The locations as yes. well. Yeah, the action in the locations. Yeah. I mean, there's a fight sequence that takes place around the Arc de Triomphe. So in each of the films, he moves to a different location. And so in this film...
And beats seven shades out of 100 assassins.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. And the cars are... So they're in the Arc de Triomphe on a kind of rush hour evening.
Yeah, it's brilliantly done.
And all these... And what it is this sort of hit has been put out on him. And so everybody who thinks they can kill him then turns up on the street to kill him, and they're all armed, but he's got his gun.
And he uses the speeding traffic to kill them, as it were. He dances between the traffic. It's amazingly done.
It is balletic. It
yeah, because I was going to say, to be fair to the clip that we just heard, you can get a sense, even with the music in underneath it and the very slow delivery. This is 50 seconds of calm, probably before 3 to 4 minutes of high action.
Oh, is even more than 3 to 4 minutes.
25 minutes of just orchestrated...
Wow.
But it's like Hong Kong cinema. You know, it is that sort of martial arts. I mean, it's completely fantastic. People are flying through the air. They've been, you know, he gets
and he himself is so actually, he's so graceful in all the fight scenes.
I think there may be a body double.
There isn't always a body double. I think he did all his jiu-jitsu and judo and everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, here we are back to the acting. Back to the acting question.
Yeah. You could be an action hero.
I suppose the way you're both describing it here, this is about a kind of a balletic style of performance. It is about being able to fit into these huge, big action sequences and hold some sense of character, which is from him then.
And the film does have its own internal logic. So it does have this sort of set of rules that carries on but they can make up a new rule and put it in there and nobody bats an eyelid.
Yeah.
And what sets it apart from a lot of, say, the superhero films is that it takes itself absolutely seriously. He's not mugging it. at all. He's not mugging to camera. We're not meant to be laughing. We're meant to immerse ourselves in this world. And the other thing about him is, he isn't a vigilante hero. He's not Batman. He's not saving the world. He's simply getting his own back on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people at once.
Yeah.
So he's not even particularly admirable.
All right, okay. So he's a bit of a nothing that you like to like.
And he's just beautiful because he's Keanu Reeves.
There is that. He has his kind of honour code, and he wanted to be left alone. They wouldn't leave him alone, so
they
deserve everything they get. They killed his dog. Yeah, that was their big mistake.
That was what set it all off.
We wouldn't have had any of these films if they hadn't killed his dog.
And most films have a dog in it.
What about Skarsgård then, Bill, in this particular film as the villain?
He's great. I mean, obviously people remember him from It, when he had a grace of his own playing the clown. Yeah, he's good because he pitches it very nicely. He knows that aspect of the film is kind of silly and that it is very Bond villainy. But he does it very well. He's kind of commendably vicious, and he has all these absurd kind of, he seems to have his own riding school.
Yeah.
You know, he goes to the opera on his own, as I mentioned. He's big enough to stand opposite this kind of quiet, almost vacuum that is John Wick. Yeah.
It sounds as if both of you are for John Wick 5. You certainly enjoyed John Wick 4.
Yeah,
there may not be a John Wick
about that,
5,
yeah.
but I think that...
Is that a spoiler alert?
No, because there could be a John Wick 5 either. Yeah. They've hinted either way recently. But the thing is, it sounds very violent. In a way, it's violent, but it's cartoonish violent. Head pops, you don't see it. He does shoot someone up the tailpipe at one point, which is not very Queensbury, we have to say. But a joke is made out of that. But the violence, I don't particularly like violence, but the violence is not at all disturbing in this, and it is beautiful to watch.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful, beautifully made, and the speed at which the movie progresses is it's really consistent, because as you say, you have these quiet lulls, some exchanges between the characters, you're reminded of the rules, and then you're off with back.
Right. So, who directed here, by the way?
It's the same guy who always directs. Stahelski.
The same one who directed them all. He was a former stuntman,
so he knows what he's at here.
He's got Keanu Reeves as a producer. I mean, they know what they're doing.
All right, they know what they're doing.
And actually, Lance Reddick, we should say, makes a brief appearance. That was so sad about him last week. He makes a brief appearance,
and it's dedicated one of his last. To him.
Dedicated to him. Right. Okay. I think this could be a high star scorer.
Well, it's my movie of the week. Yeah, I'd probably give it 5, just because I can't see how it could do John Wick and do it better.
Right, so you are going the full 5?
Yeah,
I'll
go 5, yeah.
I like a half, as you know, and I will give it 4.5, but I really would recommend it to anybody who likes an action film. It's very, very good.
And all in the cinema as well.
Action film in the cinema, Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
John Wick Chapter 4 is the one to go and see.
3 hours long, you get your money's worth.
3 hours long,
doesn't
you get your money's worth.
Doesn't feel it.
Yeah, you heard my slight worry when I said 3 hours long.
Sean.
Yeah, okay. Let us move on. It certainly sounds like it might be worth your 3 hours if you have the 3 hours to spare. Let us move on then to The Five Devils. Family tension, an acute sense of smell, and a fluid relationship between the present and the past. This is very French. The Five Devils, new French psychodrama from Léa Missieu, if I'm saying her name correctly here. How can you expand on that setup there, Ruth, without losing us all?
No, it's not a complicated story. So it centres around, there's basically around three women. So Joanne is the mother. She's a swimming instructor. She lives in this remote alpine village with her husband, Jimmy. But we can tell that they're estranged from each other. But she is very, very close to her daughter, Vicky, who is biracial. Vicky's bullied at school. Joanne works off the kind of frustrations of life by swimming in this ice-cold water every day. And then the disruption arrives in the form of her husband's sister, who initially she's very hostile towards. But there's a past secret that emerges. And meanwhile, the twist in it is that Vicky has this intense sense of smell, and she can not only smell people like her mother at a distance and things, she concocts these potions, and they're so strong that they catapult her back to the past, and she can then see the secret unplaying that is revealed. So she sees a secret that sets off
And as
action.
Ruth explains it there, it sounds as if it has a wonderful internal logic that
it's much better than my explanation. Yeah.
Did you get that internal logic as you were watching? Sometimes explaining it after the event is much more difficult than following.
That was a very good explanation. Yeah, no, I did. As you watch it, it's not difficult to understand at all. And it's a film that's all about atmosphere, really. It's very nicely shot, and you get these sort of brooding mountains in the background, the misty lake, and there are secrets in any small place. And the girl Vicky, through this weird sort of witchy ability that she has, is able to find out about a secret involving her mother and her aunt, effectively. I think that Lea Misius, I think she set it all out very well, and I think one was prepared to buy into it, and the acting was good. But I think that it's funny. I like when things. When films don't explain too much, but it really, really didn't explain enough.
Yeah, and it, a lot of it is down to the performance here of Joanne, the Adele Exarchopoulos.
Yeah, she's fantastic in it. Yeah, she. I mean, the child is fantastic too. And yeah. I think, you know, the three women are at the centre, and everybody else is, because, you know, everybody else is incidental, and the scenery, it's shot on 35mm.
Yeah, you both mentioned how beautiful it looks.
It looks stunning, yeah. But I think, for me, actually, it was just kind of overcooked. I'd have almost taken the supernatural element out of it,
right,
and made it just a story about
there was
three
enough
women.
Going on otherwise.
Yeah, I think you could have done without that.
I'll take stars from you first of all on this one, Ruth.
I only gave it 2.5. I just wasn't that excited.
Bit overcooked.
Yeah. You had no stars left after.
No, just for one
I did give it 3. Yeah, I thought it didn't quite work.
Okay, a pretty solid 3 then. So our 4 films this evening: The Five Devils, John Wick Chapter 4, Infinity Pool, and God's Creatures. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington with me in studio. Fiddle player Martin Hayes has many manifestations. He's part of the Gloaming. There's the Martin Hayes Quartet and his more recent work with the American string quartet Brooklyn Rider. And of course, he was for many years part of the world-renowned duo with the late Dennis Cahill. Tonight, we're looking at Martin's work with a group of musicians from diverse musical traditions called the Common Ground Ensemble. They've just released an album called Peggy's Dream, and I'm delighted to be joined by Martin Hayes this evening to talk a little bit about it. It's an interesting ensemble, this, Martin. Martin, in terms of the people in there and their backgrounds, really diverse musical backgrounds.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have Cormac McCarthy, who is like a very fine jazz musician. And of course, Kate Ellis, who's kind of on the cutting edge of kind of contemporary classical music. And Kyle Sana, who like is a New York guitarist that's quite experimental as a guitarist, but also has a kind of a separate life as a trad guitar player in a duet in New York, you know. So, and Brian Donlan, of course, concertina and bouzouki player, he plays with the Tullochaley band. So we know he knows how to play these tunes. But the rest of them also have, you know, connections with traditional Irish music as well. So I always, if I can find a little toehold with these musicians and invite their world of knowledge and music to connect with this, then I find it very interesting.
But if, in your mind, is it the traditional music, if you like, is the kind of the basis for everything, or it's the foundation stone of this album and of this group, and then what the others bring to it adds flavours.
Yeah, that's right. It's a kind of about opening doors for kind of trying to create opportunities in and around traditional music for other music forms to kind of have a dialogue, to have a place, to, you know, to bring the magic of what they do to this music too.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to a little bit of something which I think will demonstrate exactly what you're talking about. There are two tunes here, Toss the Feather and the Maharabon Reel. Okay. They make their way into each other. I'm going to come in a little bit into this track, in fact. It's Toss the Feather that we hear first of all, but it's what happens after about a minute of this edit that is really good fun. Bit of Toss the Feather, which is going to make its way off into the Maharabon Reel. This is from Peggy's Dream, new album from Martin Hayes and his Common Ground Ensemble. It was that move, Martin, from, in some ways, that tune starts in a very traditional fashion with Toss the Feather. Then Cormac McCarthy comes in with that piano and this wild jazz solo.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I just like said to him, you know, like, here we can, I can play a repeated pattern, you know, we'll just take one pattern of a tune, I'll repeat it. And I said, you know, just play on top, just go for it, you know. And every night that he has ever gone for it, it has been like a completely new story, an unrecognizable new solo every night. So, but it's always great fun to see what he's actually going to come up with next, you know. So,
and I wondered about, you know, because there are quite definite, you know, syncopated jazz rhythms to what Cormac is doing on the piano there, which is echoed in some ways by the guitar rhythms and Kate doing a little bit of pizzicato on the cello, I would imagine, is picking up on those rhythms as well. What effect does that have on the way you accent the tune? Do you find yourself changing slightly as the improvisation changes, or does it fit in with the melody?
A little bit. Like, well, I start, like, one of the main, like, when I look at a tune sometimes, I go, okay, well, what's the main thing happening here? No, so in this version of Toss the Feathers, I mean, it could go many ways, but I thought, oh, this is kind of a rhythmic groove thing, you know, this is like groove, groove, groove. And I thought, okay, so I'll just try and intensify that, like, and make it as much that as possible. And then if you play it long enough, it begins to have like a little mantra quality to it. Like, it's kind of a repeating pattern, like some kind of, you know, Philip Glass kind of repeating pattern. And then I just say, okay, so now that everybody knows the pattern, we can add things to it. But like, but Cormac, as you would hear if the solo goes on, he actually kind of reconnects to the real, and his improvisation begins to gradually form the melody again. Like, so he, and then, you know, he's in the middle of this, and then I hear a bit of the real here, a little bit over here, you know, like, so he's still referencing it, you know, the whole time.
And that improvisational feel is very exciting, I guess, you know, for you as well. The title of the album, Peggy's Dream, it's a reference to your mother.
That's right, yeah. Shortly after my mother passed away in 2019, my friend Steve Cooney pulled a piece of music out of the Goodman collection, and he found a tune in there called Peggy's Dream, and he sent it to me. He said, maybe you'd like this. And he even went to the trouble of like recording himself playing it, like, to get me cued in, you know. And I loved it. I thought it was very nice. And I thought, well, let's introduce that to the band. And then, you know, like, when I was looking for a title for the album, I looked down through names of tracks, you know, and I go, okay, Peggy's Dream, that sounds very nice. And it kind of lined up with a piece of artwork that I had from a friend of mine in Seattle, a painter from Mayo who teaches art at the University of Washington in Seattle, but she's a wonderful painter, Helen O'Toole. And somehow the art, her painting and the title Peggy's Dream seemed like harmonious kind of things to me. There's a dreamy kind of Turner kind of quality to her painting. And so I felt, okay, well, Peggy's Dream seems like the right thing. And, you know, and also I just wanted to, my father has been acknowledged endlessly, you know, as a fiddle player who I learned from. Yeah. But my mother had a very big part to do in my musical life and, you know, obviously my very existence.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I wonder to what extent, and maybe it was well set and the album was well set before the death of your great pal, Dennis Cahill. But Dennis and your family really, because you went off to Chicago, you met Dennis and you came back.
Yeah.
Your family really welcomed Dennis in like another brother almost, wasn't there? That feeling of it?
Pretty much, yeah. He was, yeah. He became, like, let's put it this way. He could sit like for the evening dinner or Sunday lunch with us, like, and the family conversation continued as per normal, and Dennis was there, so there was no sense
minding your P's and Q's.
Yeah, but there was no sense that, like, Dennis was no intrusion in the family. Nobody felt like they had to be different in his company or otherwise, you know. So he became really, really very much a part of our family, and this album is dedicated to his memory and to the memory of my mother, Peggy.
And that's, and I wondered within that then, within Peggy's Dream itself, because there is, it's one of the quieter, more reflective tunes. Is there a sense of a lament within it, do you think, Martin?
Well, maybe the kind of dream quality, like maybe the dreucht of a kind of a magic kind of sentimental feeling. Not so much tragic loss as kind of, you know, gentle remembrance, you know.
that's Peggy's Dream, the title track from the new album from Martin Hayes and the Common Ground Ensemble. There's such a, just this melody floating out over it. The cello's giving us a kind of a drone note there,
yeah,
is it, Martin?
Yeah, yeah. Kate is kind of creating kind of an atmospheric sound there, I think. Mm. And Cormac is kind of doing some muted piano where he mutes the strings with his left hand.
Yeah, I wondered if he'd done it. So he's got his left hand inside.
Yeah, and the guitar is just doing somewhat similarly, you know, just, you know, picking a few notes here and there and just kind of colouring out the atmosphere. And then further on the track, Brian Donnelly comes in with the concertina.
Yeah.
And,
in fact, the tune kind of goes from the fiddle to the concertina,
does,
almost seamlessly.
Yeah,
to my ears, I had to go, oh, it's swapped over.
Yeah,
from, was that the intention? Yeah.
Well, yeah, and we had kind of played with that tune a number of times, and it was quite formal. So when you hear Brian's version of it, that's closer to the written version of the tune. So, like in the first round of the tune where I played on the fiddle, we kind of break with the tempo and the timing and stuff like that and go more free form, you know, more Chanos style in a sense, you know, with the melody.
Yeah, and sure, the melody is always, I think, for you is one of the big driving forces really in any tune that you choose to play. Concert on the 26th, totally sold out at the National Concert Hall, which is great. That's a nice feeling. Album then coming out on the 24th tomorrow, which is very exciting. So does the Common Ground Ensemble, because I've mentioned you have so many different collaborations across your musical life. Does the Common Ground Ensemble, does it bring you something particular? What are you looking for in it that you don't get elsewhere?
Well, it's a kind of like a form of indulgence for me, you know, just to like gather musicians of that calibre and nature and to just kind of like kind of luxuriate in their company and presence when I play with them. Like it's very, very selfish and indulgent on my part, you know. The goal is for me to just kind of like go, oh yeah, that feels good. Oh yeah, that feel, you know. You know, I don't have master plans, you know, for these things. Like everything is like binary. Feels good, feels bad. No, sounds good, sounds bad. Okay, I like it, I don't like it, you know. I end up where I end up then, you know, like at the end of that binary choice process that goes on, you know.
Let's finish up with it's another of the lively tracks on the album. And this one, to my mind, you mentioned Philip Glass earlier on. Yeah. There's a touch of the Philip Glass feel of the beginning of it, which I presume is Kate Ellis's input.
That's
this
correct, yeah.
Longford Tinker. There's a real touch of the Philip Glass string style at the beginning of this.
Yeah, in a way, because it is like the patterning thing, you know. I remember like listening to Steve Reich and Philip Glass many years ago and going, okay, so finally classical music that embraces the idea of repetition and finds value in it, because it was something that we didn't necessarily embrace about our tradition. It was kind of like a lesser quality, as we thought. But there is value in simple repetition, can bring us to places that, you know, can be quite interesting, you know.
Well, let's finish up with that track then, Longford Tinker, from the new album from Martin Hayes and the Common Ground Ensemble. The album is called Peggy's Dream. It's out tomorrow. For Tinker, the title of the track taken from the album Peggy's Dream from Martin Hayes and the Common Ground Ensemble. The album, as Martin told us there, is dedicated to the memory of his longtime collaborator, the recently deceased Dennis Cahill, and also to Martin's mother, Peggy. Peggy's Dream is out tomorrow, March the 24th, and Martin Hayes and the Common Ground Ensemble play the National Concert Hall special performance this Sunday, March the 26th, to mark the release. Unfortunately, it is sold out, that concert, but you never know. Yeah, there just might be a few returns. Always worth checking out the box office, nzh.ie, for full details there. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan.